You don't need special gadgets to be a hero. With unlimited 1.5% cash back on every purchase everywhere, the Capital One Quicksilver Card makes you the hero of every purchase. Whether it's headphones, a lounge chair, or even a well-deserved massage, whatever the Quicksilver purchase, you're the hero. No fighting bad guys, getting in epic car chases, or parachuting out of buildings required. Simple, isn't it? The Capital One Quicksilver Card. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. See CapitalOne.com for details.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Should Know, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to the podcast. I'm Josh Clark, and there's Charles W. Chuck Bryant, and Jerry Jerome Rowland is here with us somehow, some way. And this is Stuff You Should Know.
Transcendentalism.
Man, were you into transcendentalism when you were a teenager? Seems about
when you get
into it. Yeah.
In college, mainly, as an English major, is when I kind of got into it.
Okay. I discovered these guys at age like 14.
Nice.
And was super into them for a while. Couldn't make heads or tails of a lot of the stuff they were talking about, but I just, something about it just hit me just right. So I think I caught like the ethos of it, but not necessarily the intellectual aspect of it. But I was into them big time. They actually led me away from church.
Oh, yeah, well, that's good.
I met the transcendentalists, and that was it for me in church. I started going to the woods on Sunday mornings instead.
Yeah, I mean, this is one that hits home for me because, as everyone knows, I love being in the woods and I love camping and I love my camp. By the way, we got a bear. Did I send you the picture?
No. You got a bear? Do you have one like chained up at your campground or something?
No. I have a trail cam set up, which is a motion activated camera that you just strap to a tree, and hunters use them a lot and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I got one and pointed it towards my camp area. And we've been calling it Crow Cam because we've gotten 400 pictures of crows since I set it up. And every once in a while, I'll get a picture come through at night the next morning, and I'll be really excited because, like, maybe a fox or a raccoon, never anything. Mm-hmm. And the other morning, I woke up, and it gives a little thumbnail, and I saw a little thumbnail. I saw a large creature, and I freaked out to, like, rush to the app to embiggen it. And it's a bear, dude.
Pretty neat.
A little blackie. I'm going to text it to you right now.
Okay, please do.
Just wandering through the camp. And there was something about it that just thrilled me to no end, to know that I'm sharing the woods with this squeezy little bear.
That's pretty cool, Chuck.
And he's not going to attack me. Don't worry, people. He is, or she, there's never been a bear fatality in Georgia, and I think only two in the history of the southeastern United States.
Oh, that's great. That's a cute... It looks like you could take that bear anyway if you wanted to.
Do you see him?
Yeah, that's a cute bear.
Isn't that crazy?
He's out looking for a picnic basket.
I guess so. But long way of saying that I love the woods, and so transcendentalism in college is something that kind of hit home. Mm-hmm. And then for a little while, I was kind of like, but wait a minute.
Yeah.
Is this just a bunch of...
Hooey?
Lazy people and a bunch of, I hate to say mental masturbation, but like, what do they actually do? But then this made me feel a lot better about it because the transcendentalists led to a lot of great progressive reforms.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, that's definitely phase two of being into transcendentalism is hating the transcendentalists and like
I think so a
really
little bit.
Resenting them for who they were and all that. But this brought me back to it for sure as well. I'm a big time friend of Thoreau's now again. I used to think he was just a complete useless waste who just dropped out and probably lived off his parents' money or something like that and did his own thing. It was not like that at all. And I think we owe Thoreau an episode, frankly. I think he's a pretty cool dude.
Yeah, a lot of myths and legends around Thoreau. Yeah. And real quick before we dive in, I did post that picture on my Instagram at Chuck the Podcaster.
Very nice shout out.
You can see that bear.
That was some good social media promotions.
All right. So we're talking about the mid-1830s and this idea that these people came forward with, very anti-establishment ideas, mm-hmm. where they basically said, everybody has the light of the divine truth. And we should all be self-reliant. We should all look within ourselves to find that light. And we should be self-reliant in many ways, spiritually self-reliant. Or maybe you want to go out to the woods and live and be self-reliant on yourself. Mm-hmm. But basically, everyone is entitled to freedom in this country, or back then, supposedly, and still the case, supposedly. Mm-hmm. But it led to a lot of great things later on with these progressive movements. But initially, and throughout the sort of the heyday of transcendentalism, it was just a lot of thought and talking about and writing about these thoughts.
Yeah, it was a philosophical movement. It was a philosophical movement associated with action and doing things as much as it was about sitting down and writing things out and figuring out arguments and theories to root these things to. And actually, that's where the transcendentalists tripped themselves up, is they took something that was very pure and didn't really need any rooting in theory. It could just be like walking through the woods is good in and of itself. It doesn't need a
right.
theory that explains why it's good in and of itself. And so when they did try to do that, they actually kind of shot themselves in the foot because they couldn't do it. And that's one reason why, you know, you start to hate the transcendentalists after you really start liking them, because a lot of it is just kind of hooey when they tried to explain it, because it didn't need explaining. I saw somebody describe it that it didn't need theory any more than an airplane needs wires to hold it up.
Yeah.
And yet they tried that because I think they wanted to explain it and they wanted to be taken seriously. Emerson definitely considered himself a philosopher, whether he was or not. I think a lot of people consider him a philosopher. But when they tried to ground it in philosophy, it kind of got screwed up, like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall or something like that.
It has been called the first sort of distinctive American philosophy, like truly American philosophy. Mm-hmm. And it was influenced by a lot of things, though, like kind of any movement. And this one starts out with the Puritans who came over, who said that, you know, they were very much individualist, and it's sort of that root of individualism that helped sort of inform the early transcendentalist thoughts.
Yeah, the Puritans, Chuck, I guess we actually kind of talked a little bit about it, that Protestant work ethic. They also brought with them the idea of self-reliance, of like, you know, being able to make your own way in the world. Mm-hmm. And it took shape for them in the form of religion, where there was this idea that, you know, if you were a good Christian and studied your Bible, you know, religiously, you could be as close to God as if you were, you know, some Catholic in Italy who, you know, had to go through a priest and a cardinal and a bishop and the Pope to get to God.
Right.
That's not how it worked. The individual was able to connect with God as well. And that was, you know, a big difference in Puritan thought. And that was one of the big things that grew out of it when they arrived here in America, was the idea of self-reliance in the individual, and that very much influenced the transcendentalists.
Yeah, European Romanticism certainly played a part too. That was sort of the first emo movement where feelings mattered, basically, and emotion mattered. Mm-hmm. It wasn't all about reason and order like it was in the Enlightenment. And things really took a turn after the Paris Peace Treaty of 1815, because previous to that, during the American Revolution and the War of 1812, the Napoleonic Wars, you couldn't really go to America, or I'm sorry, Americans really couldn't go to Europe, mm-hmm. and didn't even have a lot of great access to the literature of Europe. But after that Paris Treaty in 1815, the travel floodgates opened, and a lot of sort of scholarly literary types went over to Europe and started studying Goethe and Byron and Shelley and Wordsworth. And it became it was like lighting a fire, basically.
Yeah, which, I mean, like, they missed out on, you know, the beginning of Romanticism, which was a big response to, like, the French Revolution, which was, in a larger way, a response to the Enlightenment, because the Enlightenment changed everything, you know. We had a really good episode about that, if I do say so ourselves.
Yeah, good one.
But it placed an emphasis on reason and rationality and facts. And then the French Revolution came along, and the people took control, and they weren't able to uphold the ideas or the ideals of the Enlightenment, of things like free speech and, you know, freedom of thought, and instead turned into like bloody fascists who killed 40,000 people in a year or two. And so that led to this recoiling, being repulsed by the idea of just cold rationalism and an adherence to facts. And instead it turned into that romanticism that basically said, you know, imagination, beauty, goodness, these are the important things. These are the true things that are the eternal truths of the universe that bring you to godliness. Forget facts. Facts are stupid. Basically.
Yeah, I find myself, the more we've done the show, become really interested in like what causes movements mm-hmm. to happen, mm-hmm. whether it's a philosophical movement or, you know, nose to the grindstone, you know, get out and do something movement. I just think it's really interesting because it's about a bunch of like-minded people coming together in a very specific time and place.
Yeah.
Or it could fall apart very easily. And in the mid-1830s in Boston, Massachusetts, a minister named George Ripley got some people together who were thinking along the same lines as him, who were inspired by these same literary greats of Europe and the Romantics, and formed the Transcendental Club. And they eventually started publishing a three-time annually literary paper called The Dial. Mm-hmm. I think they had about 300 subscribers at its peak. It cost $3, and they published it in four volumes for about 4 years. And this had poetry and prose and literary and music criticism. And it was, you know, it was a literary magazine like we think about today, but it was happening way back then in Boston.
Yeah, and it kind of was focused on beauty and imagination and transcendental ideals, which was basically that if you had imagination, that was the thing that kind of brought you to like a communion with the universe or God or the divine, whatever higher experience you were looking for. It was going to be through imagination. And one of the ways I saw it put, Chuck, was not that they didn't like facts. They were kind of slaves to facts, because the fact was there's badness in the world. There's badness in the universe, and they just couldn't mm-hmm. account for that. That like they just couldn't make heads or tails of it. Because they were so focused on good. But they preferred imagination over facts because they considered imagination, the imagination of the individual, to be more powerful than facts. Like, facts were that Plato died a couple thousand years ago, and you'll never get to meet him because you're separated by time and space. Imagination is that you can go wrestle, have a tickle fight in a meadow with Plato if you want, and right. that can make you happy. You can go experience that if your imagination is fine-tuned enough. And then in doing that, that kind of starts to make you question reality, like just how real or unreal was that tickle fight you just had with Plato? And your imagination is what took you to overcome those facts. So to them, society was becoming increasingly industrialized and preoccupied with money and economy and stuff like that. And it was losing its way. It was losing its imagination. And this was a big response to that. And that was a huge ideal of the Transcendentalists, that it was the imagination of the individual that could make you a happier person, more attuned to beauty and goodness, and that if you were off doing that, you were going to connect more fully with other people. And if enough people did that, then you would have a much better society. That was ultimately the first goal of Transcendentalism. The earliest kind of goal of the movement was that.
That's right. And little known fact, Plato's tickle spot was his thigh.
Inner thigh, upper inner thigh.
Was, that thigh, like a horse eating corn?
Yep, exactly. There's a birthmark there to guide the way, even.
All right, let's take a break. And we'll talk a little bit about Walden Pond and Thoreau and whether or not he was who we think he was right after this.
Hey there, everybody. Here's some bonus stuff you should know. This time, it's about traveling to Orlando for business. Orlando has tons of places to host your conferences and meetings. Dr. Michael Edwards, CEO of Ocean Insight, said it best. Orlando is as much a business capital as an entertainment one. And when the day is done, you can kick off each evening at one of 46 Michelin-rated restaurants. What's not to love? So check out Orlando, where the possibilities for business travel are unbelievably real. Learn more at OrlandoForBusiness.com.
Rain or shine, every day is a great day for fishing, right? You got rain gear, but you can't overlook sunny day gear. A Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie has you covered on the sunniest days. Like, literally. I mean, who wouldn't trade a sunburn for a trophy fish? But why do it if you don't have to? Especially when this Solar Stream Elite hoodie is built with broad-spectrum UV protection. We're talking UPF 50. And it has airflow so you don't overheat. And what's the alternative? Putting down the rod every half hour so you can slather on some sunscreen. Seems like an easy choice to me. Columbia PFG has you covered with their Castback TC shoe. Its OmniMax cushioning and traction system helps if you're on your feet a lot, say, fighting a fish. Not to mention keeping you sure-footed on a wet rocking boat. So if you're going to be spending long days out on the water, and I sincerely hope that you will be, head over to Columbia.com/PFG and shop all their performance fishing gear.
All right. Henry David Thoreau.
Mm-hmm. Weirdo, recluse.
One of the all-stars of the Transcendentalist movement.
Chin beard enthusiast.
He's he was a chin beater. He was one of these guys. He went to Walden to live deliberately. He went to the woods to live deliberately, yeah, as he said, mm-hmm, in 1845, and built a cottage on Walden Pond near Concord, Mass, for a couple of years. And this is one of those where if you have someone who doesn't like Thoreau, they will be very quick to point out a lot of things. You know, he was only a half a mile from the main road, and he went into town all the time, and he was less than 2 miles from his main house, mm-hmm, and he ate dinner at Emerson's all the time, and his mother and his sister would bring him baked goods and donuts every weekend.
Nice.
And those are all true things. So I think it bears saying that over the years, the idea that Thoreau was this Luddite who just went to live completely by his own resources, all alone in the woods, like the great History Channel survival competition show. And that is not true. And I don't think he ever purported that to be true. He wrote about the interesting aspects of being out there alone in his thoughts, in his books. And I think people got that confused and just said, oh, well, that's all he did out there. And he never saw people. He had parties and there were people everywhere. He walked into town just about every day.
Yeah,
that wasn't the whole point of it all. Was that he was going to go be self-reliant and as a survivalist.
Or antisocial. He wasn't like turning his back on society.
No, and he liked some technologies too.
Yeah.
So Thoreau is misunderstood, and I think not because of his own hand and writings. I think because people have romanticized this idea of this like hermit, basically, and that's just not the case.
Yeah, no, I mean, the facts are this. He did build himself a one-room house on some of Emerson's property right alongside on the shores of Walden Pond.
Yeah.
He spent his time writing, reading everything from the Greek philosophers to religious texts, whatever he could get his hands on. And then more than anything, walking in the woods, like spending his time out in nature and just enjoying it on its face, like finding the beauty in nature and seeing it absolutely everywhere and letting it like increase his spirit and lift his spirits, and that's all he wanted to do in life. And then when he needed money, he would go work as a surveyor or maybe make some pencils in his family's pencil factory. Apparently, they made the finest in the country at the time. And then he would make that money and then go back and go live by doing what he wanted to do. It wasn't necessarily to tell people how to live. That's how he wanted to live, and he went and did it. And however you feel about Thoreau, man, I mean, like, just the fact that he did that, how many people do that, you know, and do it not because the CIA's after them or the government's listening in on their affairs or trying to keep them off of the pasture land. This guy did it for his own purposes. He wanted to, like, go live a life that he found fulfilling like that, and he went and did it. And it's hats off to anybody who does that.
Yeah, and if you're, I don't know, if you're maybe a little bit younger as a listener and you think, well, that didn't sound that radical, and there are plenty of people who do that kind of thing today. It's true. Mm-hmm. But that's not how it worked in 1845. Like, if you were a grown, able-bodied man, you were expected to have a job,
yeah,
and contribute to society and work. You didn't spend time reading and writing and taking walks in the woods for pleasure. That's just not how things were back then. So it was a very radical thing back then to do. It was also very radical to say, you know what? I don't want to pay my taxes because you enslave people here in the United States, and we're in a very awful war against Mexico. And so, you know what? I'm not going to fund this stuff anymore with what little money I make. So you can stick that in your pipe and smoke it, U.S. government. Mm-hmm. They came after him. They arrested him. He spent a night in jail. Someone paid off his debt. Do you know who that was?
No, he still didn't. He never knew. It was an anonymous relative, and he was not very happy about that at all.
Right, because he didn't want to, like, just have someone pay it. That was the whole point, right?
Yeah, and they forced him out of jail the next day, and he was like, "No, like, I'm trying to do something here," and it didn't work.
Right, but his very famous essay, "Civil Disobedience," kind of grew from this experience. And he has a really great quote here that kind of hits home to me. And anyone who thinks they can change things or can't. Mm-hmm. "Let every man make known what kind of government would command his respect, and that will be one step toward obtaining it." Again, just not necessarily a blueprint for an action, although there was plenty of action later, but just sort of a thought. Like something to ponder.
Yeah, and on that poll tax, or I think it was a head tax, which I think is the same thing. Yeah, and he hadn't paid it for years. He was inspired by another transcendentalist, Amos Alcott, Louisa May's father, who was a big transcendentalist thinker. And he hadn't paid poll taxes for several years because of slavery as well. But then with the Mexican-American War of, I think, 1836, when Thoreau started organizing protests against it and calling for other people to not pay their tax, that's when he was finally arrested, sought out and arrested. And I was reading a little bit about that war and why he and others protested against it. It was apparently an extraordinarily unjust and unprovoked war where a lot of American volunteers went down and committed war crimes and atrocities against Mexican civilians for basically unprovoked. And there was a lot of reason for people to oppose it, but that didn't mean that there was a lot of people opposing it. It's just that you can really kind of look back historically and mm-hmm. and find yourself siding with the people who protested against that war. But at the time, it was pretty radical to protest against it. It was a fairly popular war until the press started reporting from the front lines and people started finding out what was going on down there. People in America were whipped up into like this anti-Mexican fervor at the time. And we invaded Mexico, you know, at the behest of the public. So to stand in the way of that was a very brave thing to do. And that's pretty typical of what Thoreau and the Transcendentalists were into. They would look at something and say, this is morally wrong. This is not okay. I'm going to stand up against it. Maybe it'll inspire other people or not to do that, but at the very least, I will have done what I think is moral. And I found another quote, Chuck, from Civil Disobedience that I thought kind of got that point across really well, too. It said that Thoreau believed, "It is not a man's duty, as a matter of course, to devote himself to the eradication of any, even the most enormous wrong. He may still properly have other concerns to engage him, but it is his duty, at least, to wash his hands of it and not give it practically his support. So in that sense, he was like, I'm at the very least not going to pay taxes to support this. I might not be able to keep the U.S. out of the war, but I'm not going to give you money to go fight that war.
I don't want to pay taxes anymore either.
You know, I mean, it goes to a lot of unsavory stuff. So there you go.
If only it were that easy. Maybe some benefactor would pay my fine.
Right. But then that's supposed to tick you off because that means that they didn't get your point.
No, that'd be fine with me. All right. So I guess we should talk a little bit about some of the activism that sprung from this movement, because all these cool hippy-dippy philosophical thoughts and musings are great. But action is what is really interesting to me. And that's something that I don't think we talked a lot about in college. It was more just sort of an English class.
Right, yes.
Type of thing.
They should not just be taught in English class or even just philosophy class. Like, they should be taught in civics history. And history. Yeah, mm-hmm. I feel like that really does them a disservice, and I never put my finger on it until you just said that. So thank you. Thank you, Chuck.
Sure. I'm going to change the educational system, and that's where they started too. Yeah. The Transcendentalists knew that education was the key. They thought it should be free. They thought anyone should be able to go, any race, any creed.
That's radical men, at women. The time.
It was very radical. A lot of them were teachers, and quite a few of them even founded their own, really forward-thinking progressive schools. Mm-hmm. I think including Peabody and Thoreau and Bronson Alcott.
Yeah. I think that was Amos, good old Amos Alcott. Louisiana.
Oh, was that his first name or something?
Yeah, I think Bronson, that was his nickname because he was so tough.
Hey, come here, Bronson.
So, they went after, they identified education, as most social movements do, as like a key. And they definitely went after that. But I think also, like you said, it was in part because that was their background. They saw, you know, they had seen firsthand what needed, how much improving it needed. And one of the things, Chuck, is like what you just described, that what they thought the education system would be, it, you know, pretty closely resembles what we have today. And when you see this stuff and you just take for granted what the Transcendentalists were for, it really gets across like how successful they were over the course of a couple centuries, because these were the first people who were agitating for this stuff in America.
Yeah.
You know, they were the first ones just to kind of wake up and say, wait, a lot of this stuff is going wrong. This could be better this way. This could be better that way. And they ultimately, far past the times when they died, were successful in that.
I think that's a great time for a break. You set us up nicely.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right. We'll talk about more activism right after this.
Hey there, everybody. Here's some bonus stuff you should know. This time it's about traveling to Orlando for business. Orlando has tons of places to host your conferences and meetings. Dr. Michael Edwards, CEO of Ocean Insight, said it best. Orlando is as much a business capital as an entertainment one. And when the day is done, you can kick off each evening at one of 46 Michelin-rated restaurants. What's not to love? So check out Orlando, where the possibilities for business travel are unbelievably real. Learn more at OrlandoForBusiness.com. So one of the big ones that the Transcendentalists were involved in from the outset was abolition of slavery. They were fervent anti-slave activists, and not just like writing lectures and sermons and letters and, speaking out against slavery. And again, this is the 1830s, maybe the 1840s. This is not, like, there were a lot of people who were still totally cool with slavery in the United States at the time.
And yeah.
These were some of the first people speaking out about it. But these people also put their money where their mouths were in a lot of ways, including Thoreau, who was, if you were ho-hum about Thoreau before, was personally a conductor on the Underground Railroad.
That's right. He got in there, got his hands dirty. A lot of the anti-enslavement movement were women of the Transcendentalist movement. One of the rock stars of the Transcendentalist movement was a woman named Margaret Fuller, who she was never apparently super comfortable being sort of tagged as a Transcendentalist. She hung out in that crowd, but she was not religious. She was, by all accounts, probably agnostic, maybe even atheist, sort of danced on the fringes of the Unitarian Church, but religion, it was not a part of her sort of mindset. So that's where she kind of differed some in from the standard Transcendentalist. But she was, for a little while, I think for two of the 3 years, she was the editor, two of the 4 years of The Dial, a big friend of Emerson. She wrote a book in 1845 called Woman in the 19th Century. And it was really one of the first sort of proto-feminist tomes. And she was way ahead of her time. She went to women's prisons to interview them. She was a literary critic and an editor and a writer and advocated for women to have not just jobs, but like any job. She was like, go out and be a ship captain if you want to. Really, really forward-thinking woman was Margaret Fuller.
Yeah, she started, I think, at age 29, these things called The Conversations, which was a series of discussions and talks that were super feminist, which was, again, really radical at the time because we're talking the 1830s. And she, like Thoreau, she actually died young. She died at age 40. And so we remember Margaret Fuller.
Did you see
today.
How she died?
Yes. It was astounding. So Margaret Fuller went to Italy to become part of the Italian Revolution, right?
Yeah.
This is how she spent her last couple of years. The revolution fell. It wasn't successful. But she fell in love with a younger revolutionary, had a child, and they sailed back to America, right? And then
yes,
Fire Island almost struck.
Almost all the way back to America. They had a shipwreck, I think about 50 yards from shore.
Oh, my God.
And died.
Yeah.
Some people weren't, like, apparently the rescue attempt, even though they were so close to shore, was just not strong. I don't know why. I'd like to look a little bit more into it. But apparently Thoreau grabbed Emerson, and they were like, let's, you know, I don't know how much longer it was after the shipwreck, but let's go try and find her. Mm-hmm. At least body, and I'm not sure if they ever recovered her, but very tragic death.
Yeah, she, her son, and her husband all drowned. I know, and again, she was age 40. So it's pretty astounding and remarkable that we remember her because her productive years were just an 11-year period from age 29 to age 40. But it just goes to show you what a powerhouse she was. I mean, she went and fought in the Italian Revolution. That's just super BA.
Yeah, and it seemed like any job that she had, like, she just did great. Like, Emerson, when The Dial was founded, he that was the first person he thought of. He was like, well, I need to go get Fuller on this.
Yeah.
Because she's a crack writer and editor. And I think she was supposed to make, like, $200 a year doing that, but never got paid a dime. The Dial, like, you know, was not a big moneymaker. I don't think they even paid the contributor, so it didn't last that long.
Right.
But very forward-thinking literary magazine, and Margaret Fuller was a big reason why it happened to begin with.
Yeah. So obviously feminism and women's suffrage and equal rights for women were huge parts of the Transcendental movement, as was abolition. And I looked to see, like, how Transcendentalism ended, and apparently
It never ended, man.
No, it was like a sparkler. Like, it burned really bright for a very short amount of time. So, like, the whole Transcendental movement lasted maybe to the 1850s. One of the big things that took it down was, you know, Margaret Fuller and Henry David Thoreau, two of the really big central figures of the whole thing, died fairly young. Thoreau died of tuberculosis in his early 40s. Emerson remained. But again, there was a big problem in, like, getting across what the Transcendentalists were all about, because they would get tripped up in theory and all that stuff. And then also I saw that the scientific method started to gain ground around the 1850s, 1860s, and people turned their attention back to logic and reason and the Enlightenment ideals, which kind of took them away from that romanticism of the Transcendentalists.
Yeah. And, you know, I think my takeaway from this now restudying it all these years later is like, it's a philosophy that doesn't have to go away completely. And I think a lot of people would argue that it's still very robust and in a lot of ways it's just sort of morphed and taken on different forms. But you can have transcendentalist feelings and philosophies and also believe in science. Mm-hmm. And I don't think those things have to be separated out. So while it did burn bright and die out, I think clearly the kids of the 1960s and 70s were inspired by these people and people like you and I and college kids still today that read this stuff for the first time. I think everyone can take a little bit of that with them if they want or not, but it's certainly not like outdated, I don't think.
No, it's not. No, for sure. I think that spirit still continues on today, for sure. And anybody who cares about social justice, environmental justice, those are all very much transcendental ideals. And anybody who like stops and, you know, appreciates, you know, the way sunlight is filtering on a flower mm-hmm. or something like that, you're being a transcendentalist right there. It's really easy to over-explain. It's really easy to also just kind of be whatever that transcendentalist ideal was. But that was it in a nutshell, just appreciating the beauty in the world so much that you basically dedicate your life to appreciating it and not taking it for granted, you know?
Yeah, and every time I go to the family camp and I have that cooler full of beer and my mini bike and my solar power lighting up those beautiful string lights through the woods.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm burning a fire. And I got my Bluetooth speaker playing some Fleet Foxes.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm burning that fire from that firewood that was cut by the nice gentleman who delivers it down there and stacks it for me.
Mm-hmm.
I really find myself at one with nature.
Very nice, Chuck. You're a transcendentalist. Cut and dried.
Oh, I like camping. Let's just leave it at that.
I like glamping.
Yeah, it's almost glamping.
Yeah, sounds like it. You have me a Bluetooth.
You're still sleeping in a tent on the ground, though.
That's fine. You got anything else?
I got nothing else.
So look for a Thoreau episode someday. And in the meantime, go out and appreciate the beauty in the world. And since I said appreciate the beauty in the world, it's time for listener mail.
I'm going to call this Chickens in Ancient Rome. Remember we talked about that? Which one was that? That there weren't chickens in ancient Rome?
Superstition, ancient superstitions.
Right. So this is, and we heard from a few people about this, people that know a lot more about ancient Rome than we do.
And Romans.
This is from Mike. Yeah, exactly. Mike Trina. Hey, guys. My wife, Keturah, is a big fan of your podcast. And she was listening earlier today and asked me about this. My degrees are both in Greek and Latin language and culture. Chickens were relatively rare in ancient Rome, although they did exist. Chicken was a delicacy that only aristocrats would eat, and even then, only on rare occasions. The peasantry would rarely eat meat at all, except on festival days. Chickens were, however, prized for their use in divination, like we talked about, with the wishbones, and were often carried with armies into battle so that the augurs could attempt to determine the auspices of a coming conflict. I recommend the book Handbook to Life in Ancient Rome, Atkins and Atkins. The edition I have is 1994, Oxford University Press. Has all sorts of great info about daily life as an average Roman citizen. That sounds like a cool book.
It does. I can't wait to read the chapter on chickens.
Yeah, that's from Mike.
Thanks a lot, Mike. That's exactly what I was hoping to hear, or the kind of thing I was hoping to hear when I asked for your help. So thank you for hearing me. I also blasted you with the ESP plea for request, so maybe that's where you really were prompted to respond. Who knows?
I wonder if that's an audiobook. I'd like to listen to that one.
What's it called? Chickens in Rome?
Yep.
By Mike?
No, it's called Handbook to Life in Ancient Rome.
Very nice. Well, and it was Mike who wrote in, right?
That was Mike.
Yeah. Well, thanks a lot to Mike, and thank you to your SO for telling you that we needed your help. And thank you to everybody out there listening in podcast land. If you want to get in touch with us, you can send us an email. Wrap it up, spank it on the bottom, Roman style, and send it off to stuffpodcast@iheartradio.com.
Stuff You Should Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Childproofing people's homes is hard, but Duracell is making it just a bit simpler. Not only are they committed to educating parents, caregivers, and medical professionals about the importance of battery safety, they make the only lithium coin batteries with a non-toxic bitter coating to help discourage children from swallowing them. Duracell even features child-secure packaging designed to avoid accidental opening. Learn more at Duracell.com/powersafely. Available on 2032, 2025, and 2016 sizes.
Tired of pickup truck bed chaos? Meet Decked, game-changing USA-made full bed-length drawers for tools and gear. Waterproof, dustproof, lockable, secure. Whether you're working, hunting, fishing, camping, or just getting out of town. And introducing Decked Deco Cases. Tough, modular, problem-solving cases built for the truck, job site, campsite, or garage. Say goodbye to random bins and tie-downs. Order now at Decked.com/iHeart for free shipping. Decked, your truck, your rules. Decked.com/iHeart.